Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The hottest economics inquiry on the planet these days is all about why nations fail. Ancient Rome, medieval Venice, the Mayans, the Soviet Union, on and on. The fear of failure these days in the United States, the fear of China. It's not geography, say the authors, and it's not destiny. It's when man-made political institutions let political elites gorge that nations go down. This hour on Point, why nations fail. Joining me now in the studio is Daron Acemoglu. Adam Davidson in the New York Times called him about as hot as an economist can get right now. He's a professor of economics at MIT, winner of the John Bates Clark Award for Outstanding Young Economist, a big deal in those circles. He is co-author with James Robinson of Why Nations Fail, The Origins of Power, Prosperity, and Poverty. Nobel Prize winners have just gone wild for it. Scott Page at Michigan says, imagine sitting at a table with Jared Diamond, Joseph Schumpeter, and James Madison talking over 2,000 years of history, and you've got this book. Wow. Daron Acemoglu, welcome. It's great to have you here.
Hello, Tom. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
People have been talking about this for a long time. This has been the meat of scholars and thinkers, even philosophers, for centuries. How have you gone at this? How have you gone at trying to understand why nations rise, why they fail?
James and I started working on this topic more than 15 years ago. When we started working on it, I don't think many people in economics working on such topics. But, you know, we both came to the table with a belief that the politics of it was very important. So looking at history, looking at evidence, it seemed like you couldn't answer questions about the economic development and economic prosperity and poverty without thinking about how politics impacted on it and how politics was itself an outcome of the forces in society. And when we looked around us, we saw that a lot of the other scholars or journalists or pundits writing on it were emphasizing different things, and that's where our research got started.
So give us a sense of the range of things people have looked at. I mean, people really have looked at geography, where things sit. Venice sort of sitting there in the middle of that world with its oceanfront. Rome, is it spread out? And right on. People have looked at culture. They've looked at climate. There's a huge number of things they've looked at.
Yeah, I mean, I think I used to say that there are as many theories as the number of scientists or philosophers who have written on this topic. But in fact, actually, there are more because some of them have changed their minds and have written two theories about it. But actually, there are a couple of ideas, sort of staple ideas that people come back to over and over again. And you'll see them sort of dominate most of the conversation. And one of them is exactly geography. People going back to Machiavelli and Montesquieu would emphasize such things as climate, natural resources, the disease environment. But, you know, when you look at the evidence, geographic factors are not so important. You know, you see some societies prosper and then decline very strongly. And when you look in before the Europeans arrived in the Americas, it was the parts of the continent that are relatively poor today that are more prosperous.
In other words, it was South America that was more prosperous. North America lightly settled and sort of not even happening.
Exactly.
And if you, in economic terms, happening in many cultural
happening
terms.
In many terms, but but as far as where the more developed and prosperous and more densely settled civilizations were, they were in the south. And when you look at it today, those are the less prosperous areas.
You remind us that the whole idea of economic growth, at least in anything approaching modern times, kind of goes back to 17th century and England. And maybe a good place to start here. I want to look at Rome. I want to look at others. But let's take that. You pay a lot of attention to something I think a lot of people don't even know about,
The Glorious Revolution of 1688. I believe that's exactly what it's called.
Exactly.
What was that? Why does it matter? Where does it fit into your theory of the case?
Well, I mean, I think let me say a few words about our theory, and then I'll try to place the Glorious Revolution at the center of it, as you suggested. So our theory is, as you've articulated at the beginning, is all about the political institutions. You know, institutions in society create incentives for innovation and investment, and they create a level playing field. And when that happens, economic growth is going to happen. But unfortunately, such institutions, which we call inclusive institutions, are the exception rather than the rule.
In history, even today.
Mm-hmm. Instead, many societies are ruled by what we call extractive institutions, and I think the name is sort of somewhat apt, because those institutions are designed to extract resources from the many by the few, by the elite. And
so extractive, like you'd extract minerals from a mine, and not to put too fine a gloss on it, you're talking about it, when you say extractive institutions, you're talking about power structures, political structures that allow a few elite to kind of suck up the assets of society.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, some of these extractive societies were really extractive, like the ones that Spaniards set up in many parts of
Latin America. Take out the gold, take out the silver, enslave the people.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, and using forced labor. But many of them are extractive in other equally pernicious ways. For example, you make people work for you. They produce and they are enslaved by you, and you get the fruits of it. So those sorts of extractive institutions are the norm. And the reason why
Though
they
it's not
change.
Just slave societies where this dynamic goes on, you point out quite
absolutely,
broadly.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, forced labor is so common. Even today, I mean, there are millions of people today, International Labor Organization considers as forced laborers, and that excludes sex workers and even children that you might actually view as forced laborers. So it's actually something that goes on today. You know, we give in the book the example of Uzbekistan. You know, children in school in Uzbekistan spend half of their time on cotton fields picking cotton for zero wages because the capital stock of the country has gone to the dogs and they don't have the mechanical machines to do that.
I guess the point I was looking to amplify from your book is that you don't have to live in a slave society to have extractive institutions.
Absolutely.
It can be much more subtle than that. Take us to the Glorious Revolution of 1688 and why it mattered. Where were we? What was going on? What happened?
Well, you know, the key thing is that as many societies today and as almost all societies throughout history, England in the 17th century was largely an extractive society.
Meaning
that its institutions were designed so as to enrich a small elite that at the top of the aristocrats,
royalty.
And at the top of it were the Stuart monarchs, mm-hmm. Charles I, Charles II, and James II. And these were supported by what we call extractive political institutions that concentrated all political power, military, judicial, and otherwise, in the hands of that elite and in the hands mm-hmm. of the aristocracy. Mm-hmm. But there were people who wanted to stand up against it, and those were the origins of the English Civil War earlier. And ultimately, those forces were able to come up with an alternative. It wasn't a peaceful process. Actually, the Glorious Revolution, sometimes, you know, in English history, it's sort of written up as a totally consensual affair. It was not a totally peaceful process. There was a conflict. There were battles. But the important thing is that as a result of that, people were able to depose James II and come up with an alternative. And the alternative was constitutional monarchy.
So the alternative, very importantly here, was not just another set of elites. It was constraints on elites that empowered much more of, not all by any means,
absolutely,
but much more of the society.
Yeah, we should not be woolly-eyed about it. You mm-hmm. know, this was not democracy, but there were some changes that were really dramatic for its time. I think the image that captures it best is one in which William of Orange, who was imported as sort of the new monarch, the mm-hmm. constitutional monarch, he was going to be constrained. So before William of Orange was offered the crown, the first thing the people who actually deposed James II did is actually they read him the Declaration of Rights, which later became the Bill of Rights. Mm-hmm. So the message was clear: from now on, you don't rule by divine rights; you rule because we have given you the power. We the people, and again, as you said, that people wasn't everybody. Mm-hmm, it was a mm-hmm. sort of a relatively elite segment of society. But we have given you the power. Rather than power coming from above, now power comes from below by our willingness to grant it to you. And
the
if you misbehave, we're going to take it away from you.
The important thing was not dragging down the elite. It was opening up the opportunity, as you write it, for that great number of people. And you draw almost a straight line from that revolution to the Industrial Revolution and the growth – the birth of the greatest sort of economic growth the world had ever seen.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the Industrial Revolution, economic historians have written, you know, volumes and volumes about it. But today we are used to sort of the wave of gadgets that have taken over our lives in the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century, all the communication technologies. But the other big wave of gadgets that really transformed the world was the Industrial Revolution. And it was no coincidence that Industrial Revolution started about half a century after the Glorious Revolution, and exactly where the Glorious Revolution took place. And it started exactly in the places that were liberated by the Glorious Revolution.
In other words, tapping the energies, the insights, the intelligence, all that of many people instead of just a few. I mean, Adam Davidson, we cited him earlier, but he says that you and James Robinson argue that the wealth of a country is most closely correlated with the degree to which the average person shares in the overall growth of its economy. Why?
Because you need two things for economic growth. First of all, you need people to innovate and invest. And second, you need the people who do that to be the talented people. So if you have a system in which you don't provide incentives, just the Stuart Kings or some other elite control everything, and they don't even give you property rights, they don't allow you to do anything, they're not going to be incentives, they're not going to be investment. Or if they create such an unequal society that at the end of the day, there is no level playing field, only a very small fraction of the society has the opportunity to take part in such economic activities, you're not going to harness the best talent in society.
And those nations come down. Sooner or later, they come down. Daron Acemoglu has written with James Robinson, Why Nations Fail, the Origins of Power, Prosperity, and Poverty. He's with us in the studio. You can join the conversation this hour. What's the real root of a nation's strength? What really matters? What's the heart of it? And what really puts a nation at risk? Is our country at risk of becoming a captive of those extractive elites? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we're talking this hour about what makes nations great and what makes them fail. A big new inquiry says it's the 99% who make the nation. It's the 1% you've got to watch out for. Daron Acemoglu is with us this hour. Let's just get a little sound effect in here. Here's a scene from the BBC historical documentary, Ancient Rome, Rise and Fall of an Empire. The barbarian king leads his Visigoth army as they sack Rome in 410.
The gates were opened to the Goths by some of Rome's own citizens. They wished to be spared further agony. It was a forlorn hope.
Don't burn the churches! Leave the churches!
410 there, and the fall of Rome. Now we've got our own dynamics today. Here's Occupy Wall Street demonstrators in New York, October 5th. And a little later in that protest, here's protester Shauna Lucy.
I want the people who work in this area of town to know that we will not take this system anymore. The system must be reformed. And if it isn't reformed, we'll smash it.
We've got our elites. Director Lauren Greenfield spent 3 years filming the Siegel family for her documentary, The Queen of Versailles, as the family set about building the largest home in America, 90,000 square feet. Here's billionaire David Siegel and his wife Jackie explaining how their grand idea got started.
We went to France and we saw Versailles, and we were inspired by the French architecture.
I drew it on the back of an envelope on my way to Las Vegas. We kind of copied the top three floors of the Paris Hotel. Probably should have used smaller envelopes because it turned out to be the largest home in America.
I said, well, I like to have a bowling alley. And then he says, I want a health spa. And then I said, we need maids' quarters.
90,000 square feet to fill. Here's a speech from the President Obama in Osawatomie, Kansas. This was in December. The President talking about the political consequences of inequality.
Inequality also distorts our democracy. It gives an outsized voice to the few. who can afford high-priced lobbyists and unlimited campaign contributions. And it runs the risk of selling out our democracy to the highest bidder.
Big-time economist Doron Acemoglu is with me in the studio. The big book is Why Nations Fail. Doron, take us through some of these examples of failure. I mean, we heard Rome there, you've got Venice, you've got Soviet Union, but dive in and show us how this dynamic that you're warning against has worked in history.
I think let me mention Venice, because it actually captures one point that Obama made very clearly. It's all about political power.
This is medieval Venice,
when it was
the ocean power of the world.
It became the richest part, the most dynamic economy in the world, starting from the 10th century. And it did so based on a relatively inclusive system. It was based on overseas trade. Many citizens of Venice participated in it. And very importantly, it made a lot of innovations. There were major innovations in contracts that enabled them to share risks so that these risky ventures could be undertaken. They were profitable, but nobody wanted to do them by themselves. Mm-hmm. And even more importantly, they had great political institutions. They had courts that worked. They had a political system that was essentially like work with a general assembly. And so they managed to distribute political power relatively evenly as well.
Mm-hmm.
But in all such systems, there's going to be the possibility that a small group is going to try to hijack the system, monopolize political power, and then use that political power for its gains. And that's exactly what happened in Venice.
What happened?
It happened at the end of the 13th century. The people who had already made their money, and they were in the highest echelons of society, they were members of the great council that elected the Doge and wielded most of the political power, and they decided, we're going to close up the Great Council. We're not going to allow the new merchants and the new people to enter the Great Council. And that was the political closing up. And once the political closing up came, the next step was the economic closing up. They actually banned a lot of the innovations that had underpinned Venetian growth. And once that happened, the risk-taking declined, the new talent didn't go into the profitable activities, and the Venetian decline set in.
So we know, that's the example of Venice. We know from economics and history, I mean, there's a natural inclination for people with power to try and accumulate more, the drive toward a kind of monopoly on that power and the economic flow that comes with it. So it must actually take some pretty strong legal infrastructure, political institutions to buffer against that. Those must be rare.
I think you're absolutely right. It's very difficult to withstand when the richest in society want really to use their money in order to accumulate more political power. And institutions need to be strong, but that's not enough. There is no constitution that can stand against the powers on the ground. And that's why it's very important that politics should not be just left to politicians. Politics should not be just left to the very rich, that all of us should be part of the political process. Again, the key idea is that political equality matters, and political equality cannot be a reality unless we take part in politics.
Give us more examples. Everybody knows about the fall of Rome, or thinks they do. Did this dynamic come into play in Rome?
Yes, it did. I mean, you know, Rome was always a society that was neither fully inclusive nor fully extractive. Even in its heyday, it was based on slavery and lots of repression. But at least the citizens of Rome were free. They took part in politics. The plebeians that had their own assembly, and they had power in that assembly. But then with Augustus changing the system from essentially a republic to empire, power started becoming more and more centralized. And that was the event that opened the way to the decline of Rome. It wasn't just as if the barbarians came out of nowhere and they were so strong to overwhelm the greatest empire that the world had seen up to that point. It was the fact that Rome started rotting from inside that allowed the barbarians to run amok, as your clip showed earlier on.
Now, you say that there are countries that have managed to change this and pull themselves up quite extraordinarily. There are others who have ridden what you describe as kind of temporary joyrides. I mean, you look at the Middle East and the oil riches there, even Russia, natural gas right now, you say, well, okay, they can have the money, you know, the good times while they last, but they don't have the underlying structures. When the resources go away, that goes away. You look at other great, great nations who have again and again tried to step up and failed. And you point, interestingly, to Egypt and Tahrir Square. I mean, you look with a lot of sympathy at those people in Tahrir Square, but you look at the history of Egypt and you say the elites there have just never really given up that big power at the top.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I think Tahrir Square is something to be looked up to, because that's an example of people really saying enough is enough, and we are going to take power apart in politics. We really want the power to be distributed more equally. And it's very notable. The people in Tahrir Square, they didn't want handouts. They didn't want to sort of some minor changes. They really understood that the system was rotten and it had to be changed. So they actually campaigned for a true change in the political system and the distribution of political power in society to change. But if you look at the history of Egypt, there has been many false starts. You know, it was an extractive regime under the Ottomans. It was an extractive regime under the colonial powers. But then when it was replaced, you know, people like Nasser replaced one extractive regime with another. So the real danger in Egypt is to make sure that the military or some other group doesn't replace the Mubarak regime with another regime just as bad as itself.
All right. So there's the thesis, that you've got to have the opportunity shared by a big number of people who have political power to hang on to that, because there's a natural dynamic against it. And you can see countries, empires that have succeeded, see those that have failed. My guest is Daron Acemoglu. He, with James Robinson, is author of Why Nations Fail, The Origins of Power, Prosperity, and Poverty. There's an excerpt at our website. It is getting a lot of talk around the planet right now. Let's have some of that right here. Let's go to Waxhaw, North Carolina, and Danny. Danny, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
This is me from Waxhaw.
Hi, Danny.
Hi. Yeah, I was calling. I was calling to commend you on the program, and I'm definitely going to get this book and read it. I moved up from Florida to Andrew Jackson's birthplace here in Waxhaw, and I've been doing a lot of studying on our founding fathers and how our country was put together. And it's kind of like we're becoming what we fought against. I like to see the rest of America wake up from the ether and realize that we're not heading in a very good direction.
What's the problem you see, Danny?
The problem I see is I don't believe we have a government. I believe we have corporations running the government, and I am a corporation myself. So the larger corporations with the lobbyists, it pulls things in those directions. I think the people somehow need to get a grip on it. I don't even think people in the voting process, I think most people feel powerless.
Danny, we've got it right there. People get a grip on it. And let me hold it right there, and I appreciate your calling. We get one more from, turns out, North Carolina, Lumberton, North Carolina. Joe is calling. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello, Tom. Thank you.
Yes.
My only point would be I heard you use that term extractive capitalism, I guess, or extractive.
Extractive elites is the phrase, or institutions is the phrase that Daron uses, yeah?
Okay. Well, I would argue that the Occupy Wall Street folks represent the extractive side of things. What they want to do is extract free stuff from people who go to work every day. And I got to tell you, if some people are more productive than other people, and to hammer success and punish success, that's wrong. We're going to have less success the more we punish it. Okay, and just trying to extract free stuff.
Joe, we've got it, and you take us right to kind of the heart of the current political debate. And I appreciate your call very much. I mean, we heard from Mitt Romney this week. There was a young woman in one of his audience who says, "I want contraceptives, free contraceptives." And he said, "If you want free stuff, vote for the other guy." Daron Acemoglu, this takes us kind of the heart of the American debate right now. People are framing this up in different ways. Who's extractive here? You hear Joe. He says, "Well, it's people who want free stuff. It's the Occupy folks who are, you know, extractive." Many others look at, you know, what's flowed to Wall Street and the financial finance industry, and say, "Well, there's the extraction." How do you see the U.S. in your formula right now?
Thanks, Tom. Thanks, Danny, and thanks, Joe. I think it's a question of balance. You know, if you look at how the inclusive institutions in many places, including in England, in Britain, and in the United States developed, you know, unions played a major role. Why did they play a major role? Because at the time, political power was concentrated in the hands of the very wealthy, so unions played a major role in balancing that out. So now that doesn't mean that unions are always on the side of rewarding innovation or investment. Unions have often been a impediment to investment, because once they form as a monopoly, they're going to try to extract that. So I think that's the important thing to understand. So I think the way to think about the Occupy Wall Street movement is not that we have to agree with their policies or their policy recommendations, but I think what's commendable about it is that here are people who are actually stepping up to the plate and are trying to have a voice in the political system. And go ahead.
And you applaud that, but you hear Joe, he's sort of got the line of Republican politicians who are out there right now saying, you got makers and you got takers. And the takers are all those people who are trying to go after the few who are the job creators and take us down.
I think that's a very, very important idea to develop. You know, if you look at the U.S. scene right now, what the Occupy Wall Street movement has emphasized, and I think it is something to be discussed broadly, is that there has been a great increase in inequality in the United States.
Inequality.
Mm-hmm. Economic inequality. The mm-hmm. top 1% of the population, the group that the Occupy Wall Street sort of emphasized, now take up almost 25% of national income. That's a huge number. But I think the real problem...
I'm looking at a study just by the way here. This is just December last year that says wealth inequality in America may now be worse than it was in ancient Rome. That the top 1% there controlled 16% of the wealth. I have no idea how they calculated that. About half, they say, of what America's top percent controls now.
Yeah. So, but the real problem is not economic inequality. The real problem is political inequality. And I think the slide of U.S. institutions actually predates the current few governments, the few administrations, because it started when the politicians started listening just to the very wealthy. And the lobbying is part of it. Campaign contributions are part of it. But I think it's a bigger process, which is that in the United States, the average person does not have as much political voice as it used to do. And if that happens, political inequality is going to set in. And if political inequality sets in, the whole edifice can come down.
A lot of Americans are worried about this great American experiment failing now. Just put it very plainly for us. Do you see the great success of the American kind of story here at risk because of extractive elites today, extractive institutions?
No, I don't see it yet. I think we are on a slide, and it's a very dangerous slide. But I would like to put two things on the table. Mm-hmm. One of them is that in the grand scheme of things, the United States still has fairly inclusive institutions compared to much of the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, look at Latin America, look at Africa, look at Asia. Many of these societies, almost all of them, are under repressive governments that look after the interests of a cabal of politicians or a very small group of wealthy elites. Now, there is a danger that the United States may be going in that direction, and we have to watch out for. And that's why I applaud movements like the Occupy Wall Street, even the Tea Party, because when people actually take the initiative and want to have their voices heard, that, I think, is a very important part of the political process of political equality. And the reason why I am not pessimistic about the United States yet, but certainly not to accept complacency at all, but is because we have been here before. We've been here through the Gilded Age. During the Gilded Age, we had even a worse political system with the Senate totally unelected and in the hands of the very wealthy, the robber barons.
And more concentration of wealth even now.
Equal or higher concentration of wealth than now. Mm-hmm. And we did not have an income tax. We did not have a regulatory state that could have withstood any of these changes. But still, the grassroots movements, the populists, the progressives, the journalists that were open to it, the muckrakers, were able to change the system. And we were through it again in the 19th century with slavery. I mean, slavery is a archetypal extractive institutions, and the United States was able to get rid of it. It didn't get rid of it for good, and it came back in the form mm-hmm. of Jim Crow and segregation and huge discrimination against African Americans in much of the country. But again, that was changed starting in the 50s with the Civil Rights Movement. So we've been here before, and we've
shown... But without pushback, you say this dynamic just rolls on.
Without pushback, it would not happen. Without the progressive, it was not going to happen during the Gilded Age. Without the people of the NAACP, it was not going to happen during the Civil Rights era.
Daron Acemoglu, stand by, co-author of Why Nations Fail. Behind us here, a live performance at a Tea Party rally in 2010. This was in St. George, Utah. Woman there rocking the crowd with her song about unfair bailouts for big banks.
Won't you help me, won't you please? I need a bailout. Somebody rescue me. I need someone to save me from bad choices I have made.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Help me out today. I need a bailout. Won't you help me? Won't you please? I need a bailout. Somebody rescue me. I need someone to save me from bad choices I have made. I need a handout in a bailout.
Thank you very much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we are talking this hour about what makes nations great and what makes them fail. My guest is hot-as-a-pistol economist Daron Acemoglu. He's a professor of economics at MIT. With James Robinson, he's out with a big new book, Why Nations Fail, The Origins of Power, Prosperity, and Poverty. It's getting hosannas all over the place, people saying they've synthesized the insights of centuries here to look for patterns as to what makes nations come up, what that takes, and what makes them go down. They say, watch out when you get extractive elites who kind of get their claws into too much of the country's growth and it's not spread around enough, then you don't get the input from all those human minds and energies that are cut out. Let's go to John in Nashville. John, you're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. I just wanted to mention to the caller before about how the laziness of the American people has come to rise, and that's the reason why we're not succeeding, and we're going to become a nation of pacifists. But you know, I think somehow we became conditioned that we should just accept a wage and an economy that we can't really afford, and we should be happy with that. And if we're not working to move towards that direction, then we're lazy. And you know, I think that's completely on its head. It doesn't really add up. And you know, for a case of innovation as well, I wanted to ask your guest, what kind of economy do we live in whenever companies or politicians decide to, you know, advance innovation and it gets to the point where you wipe out an entire workforce thanks to innovation? And what is that left with as far as, you know, the general public when they don't have anything because innovation has taken over, and where are we left?
John, that's an interesting question. Let me take it right to Daron here. I appreciate your call. What about that? I mean, you're applauding innovation. We all do. I mean, we've been trained by history to see the wealth that brings. But these days, the people who you're kind of calling on, you're saying assert yourselves here, or elites will assert themselves on you. You know, they look at the innovation and say, "Wow, that took away my job."
Well, I mean, I think that's a real concern. People are afraid about that, and they've been afraid about it throughout history, but innovation is, on the whole, good for society. There will be losers, and we have to watch out for it, and redistribution is the way to deal with it. But blocking innovation isn't. You know, we talked about the Industrial Revolution. The Industrial Revolution brought all of these new innovations in textiles, for example. Mm-hmm. What the first thing they did is that they made a lot of artisans redundant. Those guys
Everybody's
went out.
Spinning with their spinning wheels at
spinning
home.
Spinning wheels, the mm-hmm. Luddites. You know, the mm-hmm. Luddites were the people that they made redundant, and they took to the streets and smashed the machines. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, of course, the Luddites were right to be unhappy about the machines because their high wages were going to be eroded. But without those machines, the Industrial Revolution would not have gotten off the ground. It's the same thing today. There are very important innovations that are really reducing, automating the production process, and as a result, they are reducing the demand for labor in some sectors. The important thing is that there will be more demand for labor coming from other sectors as well as long as we keep the economy going. And we have to worry about,
as you say, some redistribution along the way if you've got the political power right to sort of at least buffer that blow for those who take the brunt of it.
Exactly.
As we advance.
Exactly. That's the way to deal with it. If we are concerned about the losers from innovation, we deal with it through redistribution. We don't deal with it by blocking innovation. But here is where the political system comes again. Right now, we are not talking about a political... In the United States, we have the median household wages have been stagnant, essentially stagnant for over 30 years. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about the taxes for the very, very wealthy. We're talking about estate taxes being
bringing
cut. We're
them
talking
down,
about
keeping
the
them down.
Capital mm-hmm. taxes being cut even further. So those are the political issues that perhaps we should be discussing, but we should not, in my opinion, never be discussing blocking innovation.
But when we talk about buffering those blows, you've got politicians right now who look at those efforts and say, socialism. Now, you look at the Soviet Union here, you look as an example of failure. So that's not, I guess, where you're pointing.
I think, you know, equating redistribution with socialism is wrong. I mean, socialist societies, the Soviet Union being one example of it, North Korea today being another great example, they are extremely extractive institutions. I mean, North Korea, look at North Korea just over the border from South Korea. If you want to try to explain that with geography, with culture, with anything, or with enlightened leadership,
doesn't
you're not
going
to be able to explain mm-hmm. it. It's because of the institutions that the North Koreans have relative to the institutions that the South Koreans have.
And in the North, where just a few have all the power.
The few just have all the power, and as a result, North Korea has been stagnant for over 50 years, and mm-hmm. South Korea is over 10 times as rich as North Korea, starting from exactly the same place. But that's not the sort of socialism that's going to bring any sort of good to anybody, because it's an extractive institution, and that's what the Soviet Union had that ultimately brought down the Soviet Union. So what we are talking about is that we have to make sure that political power in a society like the United States is equally distributed, and then that distribution of political power is going to decide whether we should be going in a more redistributive direction or a less redistributive direction. But the important thing is we shouldn't leave politics to just the very wealthy and the politicians that are controlled by them.
Or you naturally head for that concentration and that trouble that you see over history. Let's go to Barry, Vermont, and Phil. Phil, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. My thoughts, I have a comment. I'd like to hear your thoughts on it. I've done a great deal of studying of the Middle Ages, and one of the things that stood out to me the most is the feudal system, where you have the power elites, the kings and the lords and lieges, ruling over the common man, or the 99%, if you will. And the whole system of serfdom was, it wasn't just, they didn't take that power by force. There was actually an agreement that was made between the lords and lieges and the king, and then they convinced the people that in order to protect them, that they would have to take, 70% of their, what they made off the land in taxes to do that service. And I feel like that's what we are in today, is we have a form of neo-feudalism, and if you look at the systems, they're quite comparable, So I'd love to hear what your thoughts are on that.
Phil, thanks for calling. Darun, what are you thinking as you hear Phil's historical
Serfdom is exactly an example, just like slavery, of a very extractive system. Some people have very few rights. They work, and the fruits of their labor is extracted by a very small fraction of society, the lord. And, serfdom is not just an agreement so that I work and you take some of it. It's just like a tenancy agreement. It comes with a lot of other things. There's a lot of forced labor in serfdom, and most importantly, it takes away the freedom of people to sell their labor. One of the most important property rights, perhaps the most important property rights, the most important right we have, is that we decide who to work for, who do we sell our labor to if we sell that at all. And that's the basis of the serfdom. And of course, in an environment in which there is a lot of brainwashing and there are a lot of threats, some people may agree to serfdom. But when you look at it, serfdom was supported not by some sort of voluntary system. It was supported by the military power of the lords. And when it collapsed because that military power could not be exercised as much, and the serfs had kind of gained some more power, especially with the black theft that we discuss in the James and I discuss in the book, when the population declined and the bargaining power shifted from the lords to the serfs. That was the beginning of the collapse of the system. So I think in that way, we are very different from serfdom today. There are many elements that are to watch out for, and there are many inequities in the system that we have. But we don't have forced labor in the United States. We don't have a system in which you are coerced to sell your labor to somebody and somebody dictates how much your wages are going to be. You say, if you want, I don't like those wages, I'm not going to work for it. But that
People may hear that and say, easy to say at the theoretical level, but in a lot of places you take the job you can get.
Of course. But we don't have company towns anymore. So even in a lot of places when the unemployment is high, there are many employers. So it's not, I'm definitely not trying to paint a picture where everything is rosy, but we should not compare what we have, which has its own troubles, to these very extractive, terrible institutions that humanity lived under for centuries.
Let's turn the world over on the other side for a moment here. Look at China, because we've seen China's explosive growth in the last couple of decades and more now. And it seems to be an example of exactly what you're saying doesn't work or doesn't work for the long run. You've got very concentrated power in the Communist Party in China. They've got this hybrid system of sort of, Chinese capitalism with Maoist Chinese characteristics. If you're right, why have they done so well? 8% growth, 9% growth, year after year.
I think that's a great question. And then China is, of course, in everybody's mind. And it's this sort of new system, an authoritarian growth path that's, of course, very attractive to some people. But I think what we have to remember are a few things. First of all, if you have a perspective in which what matters is whether some big companies are undertaking investment, China is, of course, great. They have some of the largest company in the world. They have a lot of cash. They can make those investments.
Because
some of
the state has undergirded those companies.
The state has undertaken them. And they have some entrepreneurs who are very privileged, and they can buy lots of lands, or they can actually acquire or grab lots of lands and build new fancy buildings. But our perspective is that those sorts of things are not enough. You really need the political foundations of an inclusive society. And there, of course, China is very far from an inclusive society. It's an extractive society with the Communist Party monopolizing all power and repressing any sort of dissent. So the question is, how is it that China is growing so rapidly? And the answer to that is that, of course, extractive growth under extractive institutions is not impossible. In particular, many societies have grown under extractive institutions. We mentioned the example of Rome. That sort of growth can happen, and it has happened in the past, but it happens when, without major innovation, it happens a lot when there are a lot of opportunities for catch-up, low-hanging fruits from the technological frontier of the world. And I think before we jump onto the bandwagon of saying China is a model for Europe or is a model for the United States, we should remember the Soviet Union. So the Soviet Union, we mentioned, is a highly extractive institution that ultimately collapsed. But if you actually look at the history of Soviet Union, it grew at breakneck speed for 40 years, from 1930 to the 1960s, over 6% a year per annum. And how did it do that? It did that by forcibly moving people from agriculture into industry, not having markets at all, the Communist Party under Stalin being as harsh or much harsher
than
the Communist Party.
But China's a little looser than that. Maybe they've
China's a little looser than that, but I think the parallel, the important parallel is that when the Soviet experience was going on, many people in the United States were saying, look at the Soviet example. We should emulate that. They're actually growing faster than us. And they were ignoring the fact that, A, a lot of that growth was coming from catch-up, and two, that growth was not going to be sustainable because it wasn't based on innovation. And the Soviet Union came tumbling down in the 70s without innovation, stagnated and declined.
Because
and
it was a top-down kind of elite-driven
It was absolutely top-down. It was forced. And China is different, as you've pointed out. It has markets, but still it has the same top-down element. If the Communist Party doesn't approve it, then you cannot run your company. You cannot undertake businesses, and that sort of environment is not conducive to innovation, to great ideas.
Let me ask you: you, in this great historical sweep of your inquiry here, I mean, you look at countries who and nations that rise up because they've got more empowered people than others, and better distribution, and more minds at work, and given the opportunity to go to work and apply. But we look around the world today, you've got the greatest inequality we've had in decades in this country. You've got huge inequality in China, and you've got huge inequality in Russia. You've got huge inequality in the Middle East. India has it seems as though all the countries in the frontier have large inequality now. So what happens in that kind of setup where you've got almost global inequality at great levels?
I mean, I think economic inequality is something to worry about. You know, people have different values about that. Some people, like your caller Joe, you know, thought economic inequality was totally fine. And people in Occupy Wall Street will say economic inequality is unfair. We have to deal with it. But the point that I'm trying to make is that economic inequality is particularly dangerous when it leads to political inequality. And I think I just have here from the book, there's a little thing that Woodrow Wilson wrote in 1912. And I think it's so important to sort of remember. And he wrote, if monopoly persists, monopoly will always sit at the helm of government. I do not expect to see monopoly restrain itself. If there are men in this country big enough to own the government of the United States, they are going to own it. And that was Woodrow Wilson writing exactly 100 years ago. And I think that's the real danger. If we create economic inequality and we leave it unchecked by political institutions and judiciary system and other checks, then we are going to create people who can own the U.S. government.
That's scary at a time when people look at Congress, our number one sort of people's check on the government, and say it's just not working. Wes here writes to us online and says, I'd like to know which nations, Mr. Acemoglu's view, are getting it right these days. Who could the U.S. look to as a model going forward?
I think there are many nations in the more developed world that have somehow chosen different paths to inclusive growth.
Look at Europe. They're back on their heels. They're almost on their back.
No, we have Sweden, Norway, Denmark. Yeah. So those are societies that are not as rich as us, and they're not as innovative as us. But on the other hand, they have created a much better safety net. Now, it's not clear whether the United States can emulate that, and I don't think it should try to emulate that full-heartedly. Mm-hmm. But we can take lessons from places in Europe that have managed the forces towards economic inequality a little better. And I think perhaps a better sort of mixture is to think of places like Australia, Canada, and the United Kingdom. They have the same sort of more permissive attitude to economic inequality, but those countries haven't let their political system be captured to the same extent as the United States.
But the UK is in trouble right now. I mean, it's not as though they're sailing high.
Of course, and they have their own top 1% problem. But I think the issue is that despite all of the problems that the UK has, and I don't want to minimize those, mm-hmm. and people have mm-hmm. talked about how, for example, somebody like Rupert Murdoch could wield a lot of political
and
power.
Does.
And still
there
does.
And here.
And still does. Mm-hmm. And here and there. But still, the same sort of lobbying, campaign contribution, super PAC machinery, and Washington, D.C. being totally integrated with money has not taken place in the United Kingdom, and it's certainly not taken place in Canada and Australia. And that's why for people who don't want to see a much more of a nanny state like in Sweden or Norway, mm-hmm. those are sort of examples that we can try to learn from.
So what's your message to Americans listening right now? Wherever they fall on the spectrum, they want to do well for themselves and their family, but they want the nation to do well as well. What's your advice right now looking at this country?
I think be politically active. I think if we just all of us sit at home and just let our elected representatives do as they please, in fact, even worse, we don't even turn up to elections, I think this system has a tendency to create political inequality. We have to think about balance. You know, it's not just Occupy Wall Street versus Tea Party. It's not just big corporations versus union. It's a question of balance. And the founding fathers had sort of the right idea. They tried to create checks and balances. Neither party is going to be more strong, nor the legislature, nor the president is going to be. Neither the president and legislature, nor, mm-hmm. nor the president is going to be very strong. So that sort of balance is what we are looking for, and that balance can be best guaranteed if people are more active and more engaged in politics.
And from reading your book, pretty vigorously engaged, you're saying. I mean, you're saying that this is a real, it's throughout history, it's a struggle.
It's a struggle, and some people have really risked livelihood to do that. The people in Tahrir Square, many of them have been killed. The Glorious Revolution, that didn't come without a big struggle. The French Revolution, all of these were events in which people risked their lives in order to bring a more politically equal system against the power of the elite.
History's real, economics are real, the stakes are real, and sometimes the struggle gets pretty intense. It's a great survey, and much more than that, of where we've been and where we, nation by nation, may be going. Daron Acemoglu has been with us, professor of economics at MIT. He, along with James Robinson of Harvard, authors of Why Nations Fail, The Origins of Power, Prosperity and Poverty. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. It's worth checking out. Thanks so much for joining us today. It's great to have you.
Thanks, Tom. This was great.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.